I call the Imperial Monuments Commission to order. We will hear the first petitioner. State your name.
Rains Priebus.
What is it?
It might be Rains Priebus. I'm not really sure how my name is pronounced.
And what is it you want?
Well, I think it's time we put up a monument to Darth Vader, Supreme Commander and Sith Lord.
I don't know. He's still very controversial.
He killed my uncle with a thought.
Wasn't he totally evil?
You are falling into the trap of astronomical correctness. Lord Vader was a great warrior. For the cause. He gave his life for the cause.
What cause? Do we even have a cause?
He killed my grandmother, too. He did this little thing with two of his fingers in the air, and she died a horrible, gasping death.
Yes, okay, bad things happened, but there was progress. We should be proud of all the things we accomplished through him.
Like what?
I don't know, the Death Star and stuff.
See, right there, the minute you say Death Star, it has negative connotations for some people.
Well, now it does, but in its time, it was a really big deal.
I just remembered one time he clapped his hands and five guys from my college a cappella group died.
I think for now, we're gonna say no, Rince Pubis.
Okay, that sucks. My people came from outer rim planets, just like the Skywalkers. And people forget we were slaves too. Slaves of Gardula the Hutt. How come there's a big Hutt memorial anyway?
They put up a lot of money, the Hutts.
See? You need a lot of money if you want to put up a statue of somebody horrible so you can feel good about yourself. It's not fair. And now we take you to Colin McEnroe Memorial Sinkhole.
Is that what I got? A sinkhole? This is the second time I've died on this show in 2 weeks. I'd like to point that out, that my prepared obituary was read last... Was it last week? It feels like it was last week. All right. This is a trend I would like to get away from as soon as possible. All right. We're going to talk about how memorials happen, how things are commemorated, how in physical space people, things, and ideas are commemorated. And before I even introduce the guests, I want to just quickly take you on a little tour around your state. One of the things we do if you're here in Connecticut, if you're like listening in Chile, which one person actually does, this won't be maybe as pertinent. But if you're here in Connecticut, one of the things we do, I think maybe more than most states, is we chop out little pieces of highway and we name them after people. And some of the people are great but irrelevant. For example, there's a Leif Erikson Highway. It's on 101 between Abingdon and East Killingly, if you really want to know. Leif Erikson was never in Connecticut. Nobody thinks Leif Erikson was ever here. My favorite, though, there's a piece of Route 8 named after the former general manager of the Waterbury Republican American, who advocated making Route 8 into a four-lane highway to accommodate the rapidly growing traffic in that area of the upper Naugatuck Valley. So, in other words, this part of the highway bears his name, I think, exclusively because he was in favor of widening the highway. If you walk around the streets of Hartford, you'll see a statue of Confucius, but not one of Ella Grasso. There is one inside the Capitol, but you have to know where to look for it. There's a statue of Horace Wells, a pioneer, if not the inventor of anesthesia, who later became addicted to chloroform that he was experimenting with, which caused him to throw acid on the clothing of prostitutes. And when his mind cleared about what he had done in prison, he killed himself in shame. Anyway, he still gets a statue. I'm in favor of him having a statue, but I mean, that's complicated. There's this horribly dilapidated and desecrated statue called the Forlorn Soldier. It's a really long story. I'm not going to tell it now. I could go on and on. There's a plaque commemorating Abel Buell, who was a colonial sort of engraver and lithographer. He started life, actually. The first thing that happened to him was he got arrested for counterfeiting. They cut off part of his ear. They branded his forehead and they put him in prison. And then they let him out and it turned out he was... And I think they took pity on him. They actually sewed his ear back on. But he turns out he was really good at patents and inventing all kinds of printing machines and stuff like that. So he's got a plaque. It just goes on forever like that. And I think the point is there's almost no rhyme or reason as to who gets memorialized or who doesn't. Although your odds increase dramatically if you're a white male. And the Corning Fountain in Bushnell Park appears to honor Native Americans. On the other hand, in a few weeks from now, the town of Southington will dedicate, outside its town municipal building, yet another bust of Christopher Columbus. $15,000 was raised privately for this purpose because we don't have enough Christopher Columbus statues. One of the organizers said, rather nonsensically, in my opinion, some bad things happen in all parts of history. We're not looking at that. We learned from that. You have to be happy that America was discovered. Of course, America had already been discovered by the people who were living there when Christopher Columbus got there. But All of which sort of leads to the question, like, why do we commemorate? What's the urge to commemorate, and how do we do it? We're going to start this conversation with Kirk Savage, professor of the history of art and architecture at the University of Pittsburgh and the author of Standing Soldiers, Kneeling Slaves, Race, War, and Monument in 19th Century America, and Monument Wars, Washington, D.C., the National Mall, and the Transformation of the Memorial Landscape. So joining us from studios of KQED in Pittsburgh, Kirk Savage. Let's, first of all, welcome to the conversation.
Thanks very much. Thanks for inviting me.
And let's just start with that question. What is commemoration and why do we do it?
Right. Well, there are, you know, in reality, many different reasons that people erect public monuments. But we might sort them into a couple of different basic impulses. One is about mourning, you know, mourning the dead. And the lost lives or lost bodies. We can see that in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War is a good example of that. But probably much more significantly, actually, is the way in, is another impulse, which is actually conscripting the dead into new agendas and new battles that are fought about the present and about the future. And we can see that again in Civil War commemoration and the memorials that were mostly built long after the war was over and long after people had really finished the grieving process. The vast majority of monuments to this, in the Civil War were built in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Right. So, you know, in some ways that kind of boils down to, and maybe I'm oversimplifying, but it kind of boils down to wanting to feel good about oneself or one's group, right? It's a way of using the past to bolster a position that's both emotional and political in the present.
Right. And very much so. And I would probably go beyond just feeling good about yourself to actually advancing a particular justification for yourself and your own cause at the present. And so that means not only advancing the your own particular cause, but erasing other people's. So, I mean, every time a monument is erected, it's a choice that's made to favor one history over another or to favor one interpretation of history over another.
Right. We're going to be talking a lot about Civil War monuments, but you can apply this even to the Christopher Columbus thing. I mean, one of the things that maybe people like me, I'm not a big fan of more commemoration of Christopher Columbus, but one thing that I miss, I suppose, is the fact that a lot of the people who do this, who want to do this, are Italian Americans who see the early part of the 20th century as a time where they were the object of nativist scorn and persecution, and Columbus connects them to the much earlier history of America and allows them to make that kind of statement. So it isn't even necessarily that they're Columbus freaks so much as they're trying to say, well, don't forget that our story doesn't start with the wave of immigration at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, right?
Absolutely. And that's a great example because the vast majority of all these Columbus monuments were erected by Italian American organizations. And they weren't about relations with our native dispossession. In their minds, they were about advancing, as you say, their own ethnic group, legitimizing them, making them Americans. And so, as is often the case in with monuments, there could be a difference between who and what is commemorated and then who the commemorating people are, you know, who the actual and what their intentions are may have very little to do with the person or the event itself.
So that's an interesting idea to then apply to Civil War commemorations, because as you say, these monuments started to go up after the dead had been buried, after the dead had been grieved, you know, a generation or so later, really, we start to get these waves of commemoration in the early 20th century and certainly even into the 1930s, I think, this stuff is happening. So why is it happening then? What's the psychological dynamic?
Excuse me. I think there are a couple of different answers depending on whether it's in the Union or the Confederacy, because I think there are two very different projects going on. In the Union, it's really about the centering the veteran in American life. Because before the Civil War, there were very, very few war memorials, and there were almost no memorials to ordinary soldiers. The few war memorials that existed were to great, you know, heroes, great officers. And those continued after the war. But what changed was the enormous proliferation of these monuments to ordinary soldiers. And that, in a sense, reflected the increasing political strength of the veterans movement in the Union in the North, so that monuments were one part of a project that also involved pensions. You know, by 1900, 40% of the federal budget was spent on soldiers' pensions. And that's not no Confederate. This is just a U.S. pensions. So that's the kind of Northern or Union project. But in the South, it was very different. You know, the South was the Confederacy was defeated, and there it was really about conscripting the Confederate dead into a project that would justify the return of white supremacy in the South and white man's government. And so that was primarily the project there, and it was a project not only of veterans, but even more crucially of organizations like the United Daughters of the Confederacy, who were using monuments as just one prong of a multi-pronged project that involved rewriting textbooks, that involved, you know, implementing new rituals in schools and so on, all of which were about rewriting Southern history to justify the war, in justify it as the reimposition of white man's government in the South.
Right, and that process started very early. It started pretty much at the cessation of hostilities. You had figures as high-ranking as Jefferson Davis and Alexander Stevens writing their memoirs in which they completely recast the whole idea of the Civil War as one about states' rights, of which slavery happened to be just a kind of a convenient occasion to think about this lofty civics class question. I mean, it flies in the face of everything that was said in terms of statewide declarations of secession and speech made by the principals themselves going into the Civil War. There's immediate attempt to sort of say, oh no, this was not really about slavery. Slavery just happened to be a convenient way to talk about states' rights. So that happened right away. But I think also another thing that seems to be happening is that there's, as you say, this very sort of strictly representational idea of a statue of a soldier was a relatively new idea. The predecessors had been much more allegorical in nature and maybe inclined to weave in some Greco-Roman symbolism and stuff like that. Now you just get this soldier. And it seems as though one of the other things that happens in the early 20th century is there's sort of a monuments industry that springs up. Interestingly, from what I can tell, it springs up in New England a lot. And Mark Fisher just wrote a piece about this for the Washington Post. It turns out that a lot of these monuments depicting kind of generic soldiers were sold in nearly identical form to the North in the South. They changed the logo on the belt buckle. But other than that, you could sell the same soldier, the same statue of a generic soldier, maybe change the cap a little bit, in South Carolina as easily as in Massachusetts.
Yeah, absolutely. And this monument industry was, as you see, started in New England, but then, you know, became this pervasive national phenomenon. And one of the early founders of the industry actually was a guy in your neck of the woods, is James Batterson out of Hartford, who was involved in the granite. His father was a stonecutter, and he was involved in the granite industry. But he was an entrepreneur, essentially. I mean, he was also instrumental in founding Travelers Insurance Company. So this was an opportunity for entrepreneurs to enter a market, seeing that there was now this very new kind of demand for monuments to ordinary soldiers, largely because of the scale of the losses in the Civil War, unlike anything that had been seen before in the United States.
Right, actually, and that forlorn soldier statue I mentioned at the beginning of this is a Batterson statue, and it's a weird thing because it's been moved to an incredibly obscure location where nobody will see it. Nobody wants to take it down, but it's been vandalized. The brownstone itself is beginning to deteriorate, I think, just from weathering, and so this statue, which was supposed to look kind of forlorn to begin with, now looks just unbelievably forlorn, and it is a Batterson statue, and I think, maybe to the point that we're veering towards right now, nobody's 100. I mean, it really is kind of an eyesore, but nobody really wants to take it down either. And that's a separate thing, right? There's why you put up a statue, why somebody might want to take it down. In the case of these Confederate statues, obviously, this is a cause that really was fought on behalf of slavery. A lot of these people are famous only as champions of a cause or warriors for the cause of preserving slavery. But taking something down is one thing to criticize something and maybe another thing to take it down, right?
Yeah, so it's this is one reason that people erect monuments, is that they acquire this enormous power, almost kind of sanctity, once they're erected, so that it's very, very difficult to take them down once they're erected. And, you know, this is a problem that we see across history, so that then the actual act of removing the monument becomes a violent, you know, act that can be interpreted as erasing history, or it can be interpreted as insulting the memory of those people, the group that stands behind the monument. For example, in the Columbus case, you know, that Italian Americans will see the vandalism of Columbus monuments as an insult to them as a group. And this is one of the big problems, because one of the things, of amazing things about public monuments is the way in which they erase their own histories. You know, we talk a lot about, people talk a lot about, you know, removing monuments will erase history, but monuments themselves erase history. And one of the histories that they particularly erase is their own history, because they were all put up for particular reasons by particular human beings, you know, with agendas in the present. And that tends to be lost then. We quickly forget why the monument was erected in the first place. And then it takes on this huge representational character that makes it very, very difficult to change or much less remove.
Right. So you've got the president talking about sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments. You can't change history, but you can learn from it. Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, who's next? Washington, Jefferson, so foolish. Also, the beauty that is being taken out of our cities, towns, and parks will be greatly missed and never to be comparably replaced. How do you respond to that?
Well, one of the ways that I respond to that is that I don't feel we should be stuck with whatever choices were made in the past about who should be honored and what histories should be told. You know, history is, by nature, a phenomenon that is revised over time as we learn more about the past and as we learn different ways of interpreting it. To argue that we are stuck with a particular interpretation, which in itself erased histories of its own, to me is not a viable option. So the question is more a question of method. You know, how do we alter the memorial landscape to make it tell the kind of histories that we really want to tell now in the present, rather than being stuck with, you know, say a white supremacist version of history, which, by the way, is not just in the Confederacy, but is, you know, in Columbus monuments and is really pervasive across the landscape of the United States.
One of the more
how do we alter these histories? And I believe we have a moral obligation to change them. So it becomes more a question of method. You know, what is the best way to do that? Mm-hmm.
One of the most eloquent pieces I've read recently, you might have seen it too, is by Lisa Richardson, who's an African-American descendant of a white Confederate soldier. She can trace her lineage back to a Confederate soldier named Jeremiah Dial. It was not unusual for Confederate soldiers to sire children by slaves, either by rape or otherwise. She wrote in the LA Times, "To those who would keep Jeremiah Dial frozen in time, forever trapped at the moment he chose a cause on the wrong side of humanity, I believe you do him a disservice. To those who use him as an excuse to fly the flag of modern day anti-Semitism, racism, and bigotry, you have no right. To all the bronze Confederate soldiers in whom I see the image of my great-great-great-grandfather, I would extend this disgrace. Without resentment or rancor, I would move them into museums and there tell the story of their lives. I would end their utility as flashpoints for racism and division, and once and for all allow them to retire from their long service as centuries over a whitewashed history. Wow, you can't say it much more eloquently than that. And Kirk, I think it brings up an interesting question that we'll end this segment on, that which is, there really is a difference between a museum artifact that's curated and used as a teaching tool and a public monument, right? They're not the same thing.
Absolutely not, because the public monument is a decision to honor somebody's memory out in public space. It takes power to do that. Certain groups have the ability to marshal the resources and get the permission to erect monuments in public space, and other groups did not have that. So there were no African-American voices in the public sphere. They were not part of the conversation about erecting monuments in the North or the South, and pretty much until the Civil Rights Movement, and many others that weren't involved in that conversation. So it was a kind of one-sided conversation to begin with. And in the museum, you know, the museum also is obviously a place of expertise, but it's one that is at least theoretically open to changing interpretations, which makes it a very different kind of, and it's also not an honorific, necessarily an honorific space.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to have more Kirk Savage when we come back. We're going to add another guest, too. One of the things that Betsy Kaplan, the producer, and I wanted to talk about, we decided immediately, was the Vietnam Memorial, which I think represents a sharp turn in how we understand this kind of commemoration.
Statutory Hall still has racist baggage, and Mississippi voted 64-36 to keep Dixie's flag on its official state flagage. Cause there's a ton of racist monuments in America. White supremacy is still put up on a pedestal. There's a ton of racist monuments in America, causing rants and raves. And don't forget, these guys own slaves. They totally own slaves.
All right. We're talking about commemorations and memorials. I'm sorry. And we're talking about those things with Kirk Savage, professor of history and of art and architecture at the University of Pittsburgh, author of Standing Soldiers, Kneeling Slaves, Race, War, and Monument in 19th Century America, and Monument Wars, Washington, D.C., the National Mall, and the Transformation of the Memorial Landscape. That's where we're going right now. Also joining us is Kristen Haas, professor of American Studies at the University of Michigan, and the author of Carried to the Wall, American Memory and the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and Sacrificing Soldiers on the National Mall. Kristen Haas, welcome to the conversation we're having.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about this very sharp turn, I would argue anyway, that the whole notion of monuments took in the early 1980s. And it really does involve, first of all, the work of a very remarkable person, a 21-year-old architecture student. What was Maya Lin? Maybe we should begin there. Who was Maya Lin at that moment?
She was a undergraduate at Yale University, and she was taking a funerary architecture class, and she submitted a design as part of her coursework, and she won the competition, much to the surprise of everybody, I think, including her, not based on her design, but just based on who she was and, you know, the fact that she was so young.
Right, exactly. I mean, it really was, we've been working on a show about people doing things at a very young age. This is an incredible example of that. But Kirk Savage, this, I mean, we think of this memorial now. If you visited it any time in, say, the last, I don't know, 27 or 30 years, it seems like a very settled question. It's such the perfect thing. It kind of works for everybody, no matter what your attitude might be about the Vietnam War and soldier sacrifice going into it. You can get what you need out of it. But that was not the case between, what, about 1980 and 1982, somewhere in there. There was a really, really big fight about this. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there was a huge backlash against both the design and the designer, I'd say. It was powered by veterans, particularly Marine Corps veterans, who wanted a memorial more like the Iwo Jima Memorial, something that was above ground, heroic, celebratory. But the competition for the memorial had specifically stated that it had to be apolitical. It couldn't take a political stand. It had to be contemplative. It had to be harmonized with its park surroundings. And so what they were really arguing against, in effect, was the actual competition program itself. Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980, and he appointed a new interior secretary. And that person, you know, had the ear of the opponents to the design. And so it came very close. They came very close to actually stopping that monument from being built, and eventually settled on a compromise where a group of soldier statues was added along with a flagpole. Originally, the opponents to Maya Lin's design wanted that group front and center inside, right at the apex of the wall. And the Fine Arts Commission in Washington moved it off to the side, so in a sense protected her design. But it was very, very controversial for a couple of years.
To that end, I mean, maybe one thing we need to say, Kristen Haas, is what Maya Lin, how would Maya Lin have described what it was she was trying to do?
I wouldn't put words in her mouth.
Okay.
But I think she might have said that she was trying to acknowledge the war without engaging with the details of the war. And she did talk about that at the time. And I think that was both smart and kind of impossible to do, right? If you decide not to engage with the details, that's a way of engaging with the history of the war, which is to say profoundly controversial, difficult for us as a nation to come to terms with in that moment. And so not engaging was a rejection of traditional forms of engagement. You know, she didn't want a guy on a horse. She wanted a deeper experience. And she wanted it to feel personal for people. She wanted texture in the names that are engraved on the memorial. And she certainly got that. I think she achieved that to a much greater extent than she probably ever imagined that she would. Because people go there and they respond very viscerally. They have a kind of deep emotional response.
You know, it's, Kirk, not the first time that people have had to struggle with the notions of triumphalism that's often embedded in the idea of a monument and the way that it might be pit against other kinds of notions of failure. Close to home here, I'm sitting in Hartford, where I'm pretty sure there are still two prominent statues of Nathan Hale. Nathan Hale was a spy for the American Revolutionary cause, but he only had one mission. He was caught while he was on the mission. He was an unsuccessful spy. He was hanged by the British. He was an unknown person at the time of the war. He was kind of dredged up from the vault of history because there were people who wanted to create certain messages. But Wild Bill Donovan, as head of the CIA, objected to the presence of a Nathan Hale statue outside CIA headquarters in Langley. He said he didn't want his people walking in there every day looking. The last thing that they would see before they went into work was the guy who was hanged on his first mission. That's often a question. Vietnam, that conflict isn't regarded by any means as an American success. So this is one of the things, right, that Maya Lin was struggling with.
Yeah, that she was struggling with, and also the, Jan Scruggs and the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund was struggling with as well. So it was a unique competition program in that sense, and it was the unique war memorial that did not in any way attempt to justify the conflict or put it into a historical context of national military, the national military project. And that's changed over time, though. I mean, now the memorial, I would argue, the memorial has been much more conscripted into a much more militaristic narrative than it had when it opened.
If we have time, I want to come back to that because it's interesting. But Kristen, one of the inspirations for the memorial is something that I've walked through hundreds of times, usually while I'm cutting from one part of the Yale campus to another. It's in Woolsey Hall, and it is this kind of semicircular walls of names from World War I, I believe. But the difference, one of the many differences between that and Lynn's memorial is the way that people interact with the memorial. This is something you've written about a lot, is that this memorial isn't kind of a static thing. People come in there and they leave things and they do stuff. Maybe you can flesh that out a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think the World War I memorials that she was studying list the names, and that was one of the requirements of the design. But they list them in alphabetical order, and they're typically on white neoclassical structures that are meant to inspire and to ennoble the losses that they're commemorating. But she was definitely trying to do something different, and both the fact that she decided to list the names not in alphabetical order, but in the order in which the soldiers died, and the fact that she wanted dark, reflective stones so that you could see yourself as you were looking at the names, I think both of those things really evoked a very powerful response in people. And I think the fact that we sent a population, several populations, to fight in that and die in that war that had traditions of grave decoration that were outside the mainstream also had a big impact. So African Americans, Mexican Americans, working class, Irish Catholics and Italian Catholics all have various, Native people also all have traditions of grave decoration that sort of stunningly emerged at the memorial. And now when there's a tragedy, especially a public tragedy, people come marching with their stuff. But that did not happen in the United States before the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Her design really inspired this incredible transformation in how we grieve publicly in the United States.
I remember going there as the country was sort of wrenched by the Bush v. Gore debate in front of the Supreme Court, where, in fact, the entire future of the presidential electoral process seemed to be hanging by a thread. I went there. It didn't really have anything to do with what I was worrying about, but I just stood there. There was something incredibly calming. It was a good place to visit just because it just feels like such a good place. Kristen, I don't want to get over Freudian about this, but, you know, I mean, it does feel like monuments that stick up out of the ground are something that men do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the case of the Washington Monument, there's not too much of a mystery about what that is or what that is inspired by. And here's this creation by a young woman that goes into the ground. I don't know. Is that one of the reasons that a bunch of male soldiers were very distrustful of this?
I think it felt anti-heroic. And I think she was trying to express grief without blame, maybe, is one way to describe it. And I think, you know, typically when we have commemorated soldiers, we have done it in a way that celebrated them as heroic. And you said at the beginning that this memorial represents a sharp turn, which it does in a couple of ways, but it was very short-lived sharp turn. Because the way in which it was anti-heroic, especially in the context of an all-volunteer military, was profoundly disturbing to a lot of elites in Washington who felt like we cannot have millions of middle schoolers get off a bus every year and come to the Capitol and learn that dying in an American war is tragic. Mm. You know, we need to rewrite. So the mall, I mean, two things. She made memorials matter again.
Mm-hmm.
War memorials and commemoration in general had gone out of style. A big moment, 1890 to 1920, had passed. Mm-hmm. And from 1920 to 1980, war memorials were out of style. And she definitely brought them back. But she also inspired, and Jan Scruggs, the whole memorial project, they inspired a rewriting of the National Mall in the form of the Korean War Memorial and especially the World War II Memorial, which are very explicitly corrective.
Mm.
And it's anti-heroic. They they wanted to reimagine as heroic.
Right. So a lash and a backlash. And Kirk Savage, is that what you were talking about before when you said that in some respects it wound up spiraling back in the other direction towards militarism and triumphalism?
Yes, and I completely agree with Kristen on that. It was a very particular moment, that moment in which the memorial was conceived and constructed. It was very much in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, and it was really about reintegrating or trying to reintegrate the Vietnam veterans back into society, and because they hadn't been integrated into society. So it really wasn't about celebration, but more about recognition and reintegration. And now that once that was so incredibly successful, then the second phase here of that, which was the creep back towards the military narrative, the narrative of military kind of nationalist justification, set in, you know, afterwards. And now we can see it really plainly in the whole program for this so-called education center for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which may or may not ever be built. But there it's very explicit that they are going to be put into a narrative, a celebratory narrative of American sacrifice across history from, you know, as they said, from Bunker Hill to Baghdad, was the way Jan Scruggs put it. So that completely rewrites the history of the Vietnam War as now not an exceptional war, which is the way that the memorial was actually conceived in the late 70s as an exception to the rule. But instead, it normalizes the Vietnam War as one further war in a story of patriotic, just cause across time, across the history of the nation.
Okay, we have to say goodbye and a profound thank you to Kirk Savage and to Kristen Haas. We'll have information about their books up at WNPR.org/Colin, where we'll have all the audio and stuff about today's show. But I need time to talk about Samuel Colt, who's a thorny problem for some of us here in Hartford.
Names here on the wall. It's a wall of love, a wall that heals, a wall that touches, helps you feel the faces of more than 50,000 names. Feel the wall be forever.
Statue of Betsy Kaplan, producer, along with me, Kyone Wolf, of today's show can be found in the Farmington Board of Education Hall of Fame. The Amanda Fish statue is underwater in Long Island Sound. The part of Bill Curry's statue is played by the Marquis de Lafayette statue. On tomorrow's show, a salute to women in pants. And now, back to Colin.
I know that sounds weird, but I don't really have time to explain it. Just stay with us for tomorrow. The stories that we'll tell will surprise you. All right, so our final segment has to do with Samuel Colt. Samuel Colt, of course, a huge figure on the Hartford landscape historically, and a different figure on the Hartford landscape these days as a national park swings into operation. Many of us have. I was at a garden party this summer, which has kind of got me. It was the Knox Foundation garden party where Bert Barnett, who's going to be our park ranger, is our park ranger, was walking around in his Smokey the Bear outfit, and he's a big evangelizer for this Samuel Colt park. But it's a complicated thing for a lot of us. So joining me in studio is Stephen Thornton, creator of Shoe Leather History Project, former union organizer and the author of Wicked Hartford, which will be published in October. And joining us by phone is James Woolsey, superintendent, Springfield Armory National Historic Site for the National Park Service and in charge of starting the Coltsville National Historical Park in Hartford. So James Woolsey, I'm going to ask you to begin by just giving people the elevator pitch about what this park is.
Yeah, so Coltsville is the factory village that Sam Colt built in Hartford to manufacture Colt firearms. But it includes more than just the factory. It includes two neighborhoods of worker housing that are still preserved, the church and parish house that Sam and especially Elizabeth Colt built for the workers and the neighborhood. There's the Sam Colt mansion that's called Armsmere. There's a couple examples of worker housing. So together he developed this almost paternalistic village for his workforce. And so all of that is part of the National Park. Our goal with the National Park Service is to both preserve that resource and to tell the story for the American people so they understand Coltsville and its historical context.
So to that end, Steve Thornton, there's ways in which you can tell a story. There's different ways that you can tell a story. And I know that from your writings, I know that one of your concerns is you wouldn't want a completely heroic story to be told about Samuel Colt or have him represented as merely some kind of avatar of manufacturing progress.
Right. I think that a close reading of history busts many of the myths that we've developed about Sam Colt. And I don't think he's worthy of the veneration that he's gotten with the Historic Site or books published about him or his general reputation.
We could get specific about that. I would assume that attitude, Stephen, does not extend to having a national park there, right? It's great to have a national park there, depending on what story we tell. Or do you feel differently about that?
I have a feeling that no matter how we try, it'll always be about Sam Colt. It won't be about his contemporaries. And there are many contemporaries that are more worthy, people who lived in Hartford at the time, who to me were as important or more important than anything Sam Colt did, certain in terms of positive things that he did. But I think that he's not really worthy of the shrine that's being built to him. For three reasons. One is that he had absolutely no allegiance to his country. He only had an allegiance to himself and to his profits. And we know that because he helped build the Confederate war machine up until the beginning. And even after the Fort Sumter was fired upon, he was still shipping guns to the South.
3 days after, I think, right. The last shipment went out.
Exactly. He was terrible to his workers. His biographer called him an autocratic maniac. Because he coerced, bullied, threatened, and fired people who didn't follow his political line, voted the way he wanted them to vote. And finally, he was a slavery apologist. He was the co-sponsor of a big mass meeting of politicians and businessmen in Hartford in 1859, the year before Lincoln's election. And essentially, it was a states' rights meeting. It was leave the South alone. They're our friends. There are good businessmen. You know, slavery didn't factor in at all. And slavery was the moral question of the day. So if we judge him not by today's standards, but by the moral question of the day back then, he doesn't meet up to that standard.
So James Woolsey, what's your response to this? I mean, I have similar feelings about Colt. I might describe him a little bit less darkly. I mean, I just see him as somebody who failed to see slavery as a moral question, was primarily interested in his business and maximizing his profits. What do you do with this as a national historic site?
I mean, I think, you know, one thing about the National Park Service, I don't think our mission is to glorify history. I think our mission is to help, be America's university, help people understand history and all its complexity. So I think, you know, there are lots of national parks around the country that tell complicated story. There's Manzanar that talks about the internment of Japanese Americans. There's a Vietnam Veterans Memorial that talks about the Vietnam War. There's a national park site dedicated to the Sand Creek Massacre, which is, you know, a massacre of Native Americans that existed. So I think when you talk about somebody like Sam Colt, he certainly is larger than life. His faults and his good points certainly, you know, stand out in extreme measure. And so I think part of our job is to help people understand that history. And I think, you know, part of it is firearms, the impact of firearms on American history. And is that always positive? No, but it's an important part of our history. Part of it is the impact of the Industrial Revolution, which I think is one of those things that is really important to understanding American history. And the Connecticut River Valley, the precision manufacturing industry that developed around firearms manufacturing, was incredibly important in the development of America as the premier economic power of this country. So I think among the stories that we can tell at Coltsville, you know, some of them definitely will be around Sam Colt and his wife Elizabeth Colt, who is another person who's very interesting. But a lot of it is around industrial manufacturing and other subjects.
Can you? So you've got two people out there on the landscape who are probably going to cause you a certain amount of consternation, if not problems. One of them is Stephen Thornton, who's sitting right next to me, and the other one is Bill Hosley. I think that's the biographer that you were mentioning, Stephen,
yes.
Who's a biographer of Sam Colt, and who does regard, for example, Colt's treatment of his workers, handling of his workers, as something closer to maybe indentured servitude at times than complete freedom of workers. Can you tell that story? I mean, can you tell the can you create opportunities in a national park site like this one to tell the negative stories?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it's incumbent upon us to give, you know, to be factually based and give a multiple, you know, give history with multiple perspectives. And I think, you know, national parks can be some of the best places to do that. You know, we are, you know, our nation has lots of complex conversations on difficult subjects, from war, slavery, you know, how workers have been used or utilized throughout the decades in the United States. And, you know, I absolutely do think that we can do that.
So, Stephen Thornton, what would make give you some solace? Would it be if this site had some regular programs where people like you were on stage talking about worker rights and how they changed over the years and how they might have been abrogated maybe at this particular time?
Well, first of all, in terms of the national parks and stuff, I think it wasn't too long ago that the Parks Commission or the federal agency decided to take Confederate flags out of the gift shops, you know, because this is an ongoing process, this historical process. But I think that, first of all, we should be talking about Colt and his contemporaries. And I don't, you know, I have no indication to believe that'll happen. And in terms of the worker issue, at the Connecticut Historical Society, there's a big broadside, a big, large piece of paper that was put out by workers who were fired by Colt. And he said they were laid off, but they give very compelling reasons why, because they didn't toe his line in the most recent elections, he was he axed them. So if, you know, if that stuff starts showing up, I'd be, you know, a little bit more happy about it. But I don't believe that that's going to be. Well, let me give you an example. About 20 years ago, there was a Colt display at the Wadsworth Athenaeum. And essentially, it was a gun show. And the National Endowment of Humanities refused to fund it because they said it was irresponsible to fund a gun show in a city like Hartford that is challenged by gun violence. We have 22 people on average who are killed every year by gun violence. And so I think if we're using public space and talking about it, and if we're using public funds, I think that there should be a really a public conversation, and I should think it should start with the people of the city of Hartford. I think there are a lot of people to honor and to remember, and Colt isn't one of them. I mean, manufacturing development and industrial revolution, yeah, that's great. But you don't need Colt to remind us of that, just like you don't need to put up a statue of Hitler to remember World War II. We've got the Holocaust Museum. Mm-hmm. And the Holocaust Museum tells us about Hitler, but in context. But they don't call it the Adolf Hitler Holocaust Museum.
Right. Well, that might be a somewhat exaggerated analogy, but I take your point. Stephen Thornton, creator of the Shoe Leather History Project. So, James Woolsey, I'll give you the last word. I assume a place like the Coltsville National Historical Park in Hartford can be a kind of dynamic place where the story does change, and maybe there are forums where we have some of these conversations.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, you know, one of the first things that we'll start doing now as the park is established, because actually it's not even established yet. We're in the process of fulfilling some conditions for establishment. Congress passed a bill to authorize the park, but it's not even been established yet. But I mean, we will do community engagement. We'll invite scholars in. So we'll get together a really well-rounded group of people of diverse ideological perspectives, and we'll develop a series of interpretive themes and storylines that we will use to tell the story to people who come, you know, throughout the country and around the world. You know, I think that This story is a fascinating and interesting one. Congress passed this law because there was really this contingent of people who felt that it was important enough to tell the story to our nation. So, you know, and I think this is going to be a fascinating place to see it happen.
All right. We're going to have to stop it there. Thanks to Stephen Thornton and to James Woolsey, Superintendent, Springfield Armory National Historic Site for National Park Service. Thanks to everybody who worked on this show, especially Betsy Kaplan. I do have a statue of Betsy Kaplan, but I don't really show it to the public.
Drink a toast to my best friend, Samuel Cope. I drink a toast to my best friend, Samuel Cope.
Okay, statue of Robert E. Lee, after 133 years, you are taken down. How do you feel?
Better. Much better.
Me too.